From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The Others. Spanish director Alejandro Amenábar's first English-language feature is a horror movie that's also about light and shadow and metaphor. It stars Nicole Kidman. We'll talk with Alan Kurzweil about his much-anticipated new novel, The Grand Complication. Kurzweil's first book, A Case of Curiosities, came out almost 10 years ago to great critical acclaim. We find out what took him so long. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead compares a reissue of a classic Miles Davis performance to a new release by the Chicago Underground Quartet, and rock critic Ken Tucker looks at the work of two female musicians. It's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. Israeli forces and Palestinians engaged in heavy fighting on the West Bank earlier today in the wake of Israel's deepest incursion into Palestinian territory since the current conflict began. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Gunfire, mortars, and tank shells exploded in West Bank towns as Palestinians reacted to Israel's decision to send tanks into the Palestinian-controlled town of Jenin. A police station was destroyed there in response, Israel said, to Sunday's suicide bombing near Haifa. In Beit Jala, south of Jerusalem, fighting raged for hours. Jerusalem Mayor Ehud Olmert said the situation there was bad enough that he would advise the army to escalate its response.
And to change the pattern of our reaction, no more just shooting from our distance, but a ground operation that will change the realities in Beit Jala and Beit Lechem.
Three Palestinians were wounded in Bethlehem, and one Israeli was injured by flying glass in the Jewish settlement of Gilo. Palestinians said they had evacuated police offices in Bethlehem, fearing an Israeli attack. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Saying the Mideast is a cauldron of violence, President Bush called today for an end to the cycle of bloodshed in the region. The president spoke to reporters in Colorado. His comments were in response to the Israeli tank incursion into the West Bank town of Jenin Monday. Mr. Bush urged the Israelis to exercise restraint and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to clamp down on suicide bombings. Ethnic Albanian militants in Macedonia say they will voluntarily disarm once NATO troops are deployed in the southern Balkan country. Up to 3,500 NATO troops are expected in the region soon to help bolster a shaky peace deal that was signed yesterday between ethnic Albanian and Macedonian politicians. NPR's Guy Raz reports from Skopje.
The announcement came after NATO brokers convinced the Macedonian government to extend amnesty to rebels who voluntarily disarm. But only those whose war crimes do not fall under the jurisdiction of the International War Crimes Tribunal will be granted amnesty. Leaders of the self-styled National Liberation Army, which launched its insurgency against Macedonian forces last February, say they have accepted the political agreement signed yesterday. The rebels were not part of the formal peace negotiations, but their disarmament is something that Macedonian politicians demanded during negotiations with their ethnic Albanian counterparts. For its part, NATO required both sides to honor an unconditional ceasefire before alliance troops are deployed to Macedonia. That can happen as early as next week. Guy Raz, NPR News, Skopje.
Another attack was launched today by U.S. warplanes targeting a radar site in southern Iraq's no-fly zone. The Pentagon says only one site was hit this time around. Last week, a large-scale air attack went after three separate locations. U.S. officials say Iraq's air defenses are being targeted because they are getting more effective and more threatening to Allied pilots. The Dow was down 3 points today. The Nasdaq lost 17 points at 1964, and the S&P was down 4.5. This is NPR. The mayor of the Puerto Rican island of Vieques was sentenced today to 4 months in prison for trespassing unrestricted land. The sentence is being called one of the stiffest handed down against the hundreds of people who have protested Navy war games on the island. In handing down the sentence, the judge said it was time to solve the dispute through legal means, not trespassing. The Navy has conducted military exercises in the area for 60 years. An American astronaut and two Russian cosmonauts are getting emergency survival training on Space Station Alpha. The three men became the latest full-time crew on the outpost after arriving on Space Shuttle Discovery. From member station WMFE, Pat Duggins has more.
Astronaut Frank Culbertson and cosmonauts Vladimir Dezhurov and Mikhail Turin were briefed by the outgoing station crew on what to do in case of a disaster. If the outpost's hull were punctured, the three crewmen might have as little as 8 minutes to escape in a Russian Soyuz crew capsule. The astronauts aboard Space Shuttle Discovery also assembled a temporary sleep station in the Destiny lab. Space Station Alpha only has 2 bunks, so one of the three crewmen up to now had to make do with a sleeping bag. The new sleep station is about the size of 2 phone booths. It has room to hang pictures, a workstation, and personal storage. The 2 other bunks in the Zvezda crew cabin do have one advantage. Each has a private 6-inch porthole to see the Earth through. There's no window on the new cabin. The first of 2 planned spacewalks is set for this coming Thursday. Space Shuttle Discovery lands back in Florida a week from tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Midway Airlines is laying off half of its workforce and sharply cutting service. The North Carolina-based carrier has filed for bankruptcy and plans to lay off some 700 workers. Midway blames a sharp drop in business travel for its losses. Nearly 200 pilots are among those losing their jobs. I'm Mac Lee, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. Alejandro Amenábar's new film, The Others, opened in theaters around this country last weekend. It's a horror movie about a mother and her 2 children who live in a big, creepy house on the British island of Jersey, just off the coast of France, at the end of the Second World War. Amenábar is a Spanish director making his first English-language movie with Nicole Kidman as his star. He also wrote The Others and composed the music, which sets the gothic tone at the very beginning of the film.
Now, children, are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. This story started many thousands of years ago, but it was all over in just 7 days. All that long, long time ago, none of the things we can see now, the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth, the animals and plants, not a single one existed. Only God existed. And so only he could have made them. And he did.
The opening sequence from the new movie, The Others. Director Alejandro Amenábar joins us now on the line from Madrid. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Why did you decide to introduce this film to us as a fairy tale? That's Once Upon a Time we just heard there.
Well, I think it was just inspiring to me. But I think there is also a homage to The Night of the Hunter, which starts in a very naive way. And since I was brought up in Catholicism when I was a kid, and I used to hear all these stories about the Bible, and the way they tried to tell them to us was like trying to make them really, really entertaining. Mm-hmm. I thought that could be interesting. And I wanted to put the audience in the role of a child, trying to feel themselves as children.
There are a lot of contradictions in Grace, the mother, the Nicole Kidman character. I mean, for one thing, she is a very devout Catholic with a very firm idea of what the afterlife is supposed to be. And we're going to hear a scene here where she drills her children, who are played by Alakina Mann and James Bentley, on their Bible lessons.
I see. So you both would have lied to the point of denying Christ. Oh, you'd have saved your heads being chopped off by the Romans, that's true. But what would have happened afterwards?
When?
In the next life. The one that's waiting for us after we die, where would you have gone?
Oh.
Where, Nicholas?
To the children's limbo.
What is the children's limbo, Anne?
One of the 4 hells.
Which are?
Me.
No, let him answer. Which are?
There's the hell where the damned go. Then there's purgatory.
Yeah.
And the bosom of Abraham, yeah, where the just go, and limbo where children go.
At the center of the earth, where it's very, very hot. That's where children go who tell lies, but they don't just go there for a few days. Oh, no. No, they're damned. Forever. Think about it. Try to imagine the end of eternity. Close your eyes. Close your eyes and try to imagine it. forever. Pain. Forever.
That was a scene from The Others. My guest is the director, Alejandra Amenábar. At the same time, though, that she's going through this fire and brimstone theology, there's nothing in her faith that will explain the creepy things that are going on around her.
Yeah, for me, that was tricky to have this opposition between religion and ghosts, because for me it was important that she would realize that she would accept this ghost war in a different way once she is able to realize that she hasn't got the complete truth. Mm-hmm. And that was tricky because supposedly ghost tradition has to do with religious tradition. So I had to set it up in the opposite way.
I don't want to give too much away for those who haven't seen The Others, but on the metaphysical level, there is no religious confrontation in the movie. There is no battle between good and evil here.
Oh, yeah. That was a very important thing for me when I decided to do this story, which has to do a lot with the tradition, Gothic tale. And because I think that many times these Victorian stories end up with the same battle between good and evil. And I wanted to explore something much complexer, at least for the characters, to find out at the end. So that at the end, it's not about being good and evil, and it's not about this house burning or exploding. It's something much more quieter and subtle.
There are very few, if any, special effects in this movie, and when creepy stuff happens, you tend to show us not the action, what's happening, you show us people's reaction.
Yeah, actually, that's in my three films. For instance, if I did a film about violence, I try the audience to be aware of it and try to mean the, or to tell them something. I think I would put the camera on the faces of the actors. I find it much more interesting. And the whole thing about mystery, for instance, in this movie, is about not showing the monster. This is something that many, even producers, would agree about. But in the end, many times, I think that horror films, and I'm very fond of this genre, end up being a parade of special effects. So that's what I prefer to play with hidden things. And also because I always try to look for a subjective point of view. I try to adopt the point of view of one of the characters and try to put the audience with them, to the audience go with them. And that has to do with not seeing, with discovering things with the movie.
You are not only the director of this movie and the writer of the movie, but also the composer of the music. And at the same time, a lot of people, in speaking about this movie, talk about how quiet it is.
Yeah, it's for me, silence is a very important element, even to create suspense. And when we are talking about a film about ghosts, and we could think about all these special effects and ghosts flying around, ghosts walking through walls. We also could think about sound effects. And I think that sometimes in many movies it's just becoming insane, the level of the mixes. So
By that you mean how loud they are?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like sometimes it seems that you need to have earplugs when you go to the movies. And I think it's important to have the audience and have them really paying attention to what the characters are saying. And sometimes the characters are in silence and they're listening things. And so I wanted the audience to be in the same position, in a very, very natural and quiet level. And I think that's not against suspense, that's not against horror, that's not against emotions. It's just setting the movie in its natural place.
You've written the music to all of your movies. Did you start as a musician or as a filmmaker?
I think actually I started as a musician. I never studied music, but I started to be interested on soundtracks when I was a child. And So I used to listen to soundtracks, and then I started to write my little tales and to compose the music for those tales without knowing what that actually meant. And I also did the drawing for the tales. So I think that all that ended up being director, writer, and composer. But it was actually the three aspects of it. Composing was really for fun at the beginning. I did it in my short films, and then my producers asked me to try in my first feature film.
But this is the work of a very accomplished musician.
Oh, thank you. As I said, I never studied music. I've been told to, but I think at this point it would really delay me when I'm writing. I have to be focused on writing, then I have to be focused on directing, and then I have to be focused on composing. So I never have time to really learn music. And I help myself with computers. I always worked with keyboards, and now with a computer with a multi-track, and so I can with samples, so that I can really play very close similar sounds to the final performance of the orchestra. And of course I work with in this film I worked with three orchestrators.
My guest is Alejandro Amenábar, composer, writer, and director of the new movie, The Others. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is director Alejandro Amenábar. His new film is The Others. Now, you wrote The Others originally in Spanish?
Yeah, I did.
And you are now in Madrid. As I understand it, you're dubbing the film from English into Spanish.
Exactly.
Are you using your original script?
Yeah, well, actually, that's one of my intentions. Of course, no, you have to be based on the English version because, of course, there were changes. Because when we translated into English, we didn't want it to sound like a translation. So we had to change things. And of course, when you shoot a film, you do changes and during shooting. But now I'm trying to get back some of the freshness of the original Spanish version for the dubbing version. But it's very close to the English version.
This movie is a star vehicle. You really needed Nicole Kidman or an actress, a very good actress, to carry a lot of this film. Stars, though, when you sign a real star, that comes with an awful lot of baggage. There's an awful lot that goes with it.
Yeah, what happened in this case is that the movie was increasing and being bigger. But in the beginning, it was meant to be a very, very simple and very small film shot in South America. That was my first idea. And I would say it's a weird film from the production point of view. There are money and forces from Hollywood and from Spain. But we tried to preserve the nature of the film.
Did you ever worry about losing control?
Well, that's the obsession of any director, losing control. I think that was my first obsession when I directed my first film when I was 23, because I thought that nobody was going to pay me attention because I was so young. And that was my first obsession, but then that wasn't a problem at all. And then in the second film, my obsession was the contrary. I thought that maybe now everybody was going to say yes to anything I said, and that's scary too. And in this case, because you see how the project is really getting bigger, you think that you could lose control, but it wasn't the case at all. And I think we all had an excellent relationship, actually, based on respect.
You were working with one of the most glamorous couples in the world, your star Nicole Kidman and her then-husband executive producer Tom Cruise. Then, while The Others is still in production, they announced their plans to divorce. Now, what was it like to work amid what must have been a media circus?
Well, it's something inevitable. These things happen. And but the important thing to me is that Thomas, executive producer, and Nicole, as the star of the film, they have been incredibly supportive with the film, with me. They were the other day in LA at the premiere, giving their support to the film. So I'm very proud of them, and I think they are very, very professional.
Tom Cruise stars in a remake of your earlier film, Open Your Eyes. It's been retitled Vanilla Sky, and as I understand, it's scheduled to open up later this year. You were at least informally asked if you wanted to direct the remake.
Yeah, informally, as you say.
You turned it down.
Yeah, but I think we all realized, and Tom and I realized that it shouldn't have been the project that I had to do, because it was very close. The film I just had done, Open Your Eyes, and I had this script already written, and I think it's better for someone else with new energy, with new input, and with new talent to have the project with energy, basically. And I haven't seen anything of the film at all, but they deserve to do their film. I'm very proud of it, and I'm not concerned at all.
I'm speaking with Alejandro Amenábar. His new film is The Others. Now, when you were growing up, you have clearly, by looking at your films, you've seen an awful lot of American and English movies.
Well, actually, yeah. I started watching Hollywood films, American films, when I was a child. I was 10 years old, and I started to watch them on video. And I used to like the horror films, especially. And I think that's how I became interested. But
You watched them on video?
Yeah, I started on video. And then when I was a teenager, I started to go to the movies, actually to the theater. And I discovered how wonderful it is. But yeah, I started watching first TV.
You were born in Chile, but grew up in Madrid.
Yeah, exactly.
And where were all these American movies?
Where?
Where? Who had them? Where did?
Yeah,
you...
actually, it was an American neighbor that we had, a couple, and they had video in the 80s at the beginning when nobody still had in Spain, and then invited my brother and I to the house to watch these movies, and that's how I became interested. Actually, the man, the husband, he always appears in my films.
Really?
The kind of homage, yeah, he always appears.
He's the
in The Others. He's one of the dead people in the Book of the Dead.
So this is your Hitchcock homage as well.
Yeah, I like that kind of cameos.
I wanted to play a scene from your first feature film. This is a scene in the cafeteria of a film school. A girl has just met boy, and they're studying at separate tables, listening to music on their headphones, a separate headphone, separate music. And when you edited this, we hear his music when the camera is shooting from his point of view, and her music when we're seeing what she sees, and we hear the sound of the cafeteria when there's a shot of both of them. Let's listen. Boy Meets Girl on the soundtrack of the film Thesis. And Alejandro Amenábar, that film is titled Thesis. Are we listening to the work of the diligent film student there?
Diligent,
hardworking film student.
No, I wasn't at all. I was a very bad student, actually. I used to be a very good student because I wanted to study film. I thought that would be the less boring studies when I got to the university. And unfortunately, to me, it was a disaster. I got really, really bored, and I started then to be a very bad student. But I did short films instead.
You failed the directing course, in fact.
Yeah. but these things happen. I mean, it's just, I understand that, as I said, I wasn't very, very good student, because I had the feeling that I wasn't really studying anything that could help me in this profession. And actually the real learning started when I did my first film.
What was the purpose of that cross-cutting in the cafeteria scene? You're establishing the idea, it seems to me, that there's going to be point of view of camera work.
Yeah, it's a crazy thing that it was in the script originally. And when I shot it and I mixed it, my producer was completely against it. He actually didn't like it. But to me, it was important because it has to do with a subjective point of view, which is always, for me, very, very important. And in this case, associated to sound, to music, and how reality can change the perception of reality, change the sound. And sound is so important in my films, and especially in that first one. So that's why I thought it was very, very important playing with that change of music.
There are a lot of jokes in that first movie about the movie business and about film school. At one point in the movie, the class of film students is told that their professor has died while watching a movie in a screening room. And one of your characters then says the wisecrack, it must have been Spanish.
Well, when people used to ask about that in Spain, I always said that was what the character would have said, because actually that character was based in a very close friend of mine who used to hate Spanish movies. And I like that kind of joke. But for me, the whole theme about setting this plot of snuff movies in a university, I think that was a kind of joke there.
What are you working on next? What's your next project?
Going to Venice to present the film. And then come back to Spain, release at last the film in Spain, and then have long holidays. Honestly, I haven't thought about my next film yet. I always need to get rid of my previous work in order to think about the next one. Always.
Alejandro Amenábar, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Alejandro Amenábar's new movie is The Others. His previous film, Open Your Eyes, has been remade in English as Vanilla Sky. That picture is due out later this year. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Universal Pictures, presenting Captain Corelli's Mandolin from the director of Shakespeare in Love, starring Nicolas Cage and Penelope Cruz. Opens August 17th nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to the Chicago Underground Quartet. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead has a review. Also, Ken Tucker on new albums from Gillian Welch and Nick Acosta. And we'll meet Alan Kurzweil. His long-awaited novel is The Grand Complication. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, filling in for Terry Gross. In rock and roll, image can be nearly as important as the music it decorates. Rock critic Ken Tucker thinks two very different musicians, Gillian Welch, an emulator of simple folk music, and Nick Acosta, a rocker who happens to be Frank Sinatra's goddaughter, have taken similar approaches to the construction of their images, yet have come up with opposite results.
That's Nick Acosta singing Like a Feather. It's from her debut album, which is called Everybody Got Their Something, but you might be more familiar with it from its placement in a Tommy Hilfiger commercial that in turn has landed the song endless plays on MTV. Costa reeks of showbiz. Her father, Don Costa, was Frank Sinatra's arranger and occasional producer for many years. Sinatra was her godfather, and as a child, she launched a singing career in Europe that, her record company bio quotes her as saying, found her 8 years old and opening for the Police in Chile. 8 years old, Sting, the home of General Augusto Pinochet. To me, that one phrase of Costas's carries more contradictions and implications than an entire volume of surrealist manifestos. In her adult incarnation, Costa is, if you'll excuse the expression, a real babe, flaunting her curves and her belter's voice with abandon. Like so many white rockers, the ache in her voice comes from the intensity with which she wants to be black, specifically to be Lauryn Hill or Erykah Badu, whose producers she's hired to help in her dream. Costa is, in short, as inauthentic as can be, but darned if the title tune, a variation on Sly Stone's Family Affair, doesn't have the diluted power of good phony baloney.
My face to the sky, dreaming about just how.
In contrast to the overripe, music-loving Nick Acosta, there's the astringent, music-ambivalent Gillian Welch. Welch's two previous CDs were lavishly praised for what reviewers invariably refer to as her timeless compositions, which in her case means being vague and portentous. Where a performer like Nick Acosta shakes her booty on the cover of her CD, Welch tries in all her photographs to look as if she's just shaking, quivering neurasthenically, as if bearing the weight of tradition is all just too much for her. By all accounts a child of privilege, Welch seems to have constructed her image from looking enviously at Walker Evans' photographs of women living in rural poverty. I think I'd have a heart attack if Welch ever released a CD whose liner notes didn't include a photo of her in big, clunky, sensible shoes.
Oh, I dream.
On her new CD called Time the Revelator, Welch offers what may be the worst song ever written about Elvis Presley.
I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? I was thinking that night about Elvis. Did he die? Did he die? Just a country boy that combed his hair, put on a shirt his mother made, and went on the air, and he shook it like a chorus girl. and it shook it like a Harlem queen. And it shook it like a midnight rambler, baby, like you never seen, like you never seen, never seen. I was thinking.
He shook it like a chorus girl. He shook it like a Harlem queen. I think it might fall under some obscure FBI provision that RuPaul could be deputized to arrest Gillian Welch for perpetrating a crime against the king. Here's a more typical Welch composition.
And the great board sank, and the old keys fled, and the great emancipator took a bullet in the head.
Gillian Welch has benefited from the popularity of the soundtrack to the most recent Coen Brothers movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Unlike the movie, which soars on the strength of George Clooney's tremendously energetic, open-hearted performance, the soundtrack partakes of the same kind of consciously repressed emotionalism Welch insists upon. If you're going to be derivative or phony, I say, go all out, don't hold back. When Nika Costa decides to rip off the black artist she loves, she doesn't just sample a riff or emulate their phrasing, she grabs hold of an emotion and wrings its neck. The result isn't great music, but it's certainly got some life in it.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, Alan Kurzweil tells us about his new literary thriller, This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. After the great success of Alan Kurzweil's novel, A Case of Curiosities, readers have anticipated his second book for almost 10 years. The Grand Complication is the name of both Kurzweil's new novel and the wondrous watch that ticks away at the heart of the plot. The timepiece is also known as The Queen. It's a real watch, but it's been missing ever since it was stolen from a museum in 1983. It was commissioned exactly 200 years earlier by Marie Antoinette, who gave the greatest watchmaker in France an unlimited budget to create a masterpiece. In Kurzweil's book, an eccentric collector entices a naive librarian into a campaign to find the queen, and much of the action in this literary thriller is set in the New York Public Library. I asked Alan Kurzweil to describe the queen.
It was a spare-no-expense commission by the greatest of 18th-century watchmakers, Abraham Louis Breguet. The complication in the title also refers to the gizmos in the watch. And when a watch has more than five such gizmos, sidereal timekeeping, chronographs, which is a fancy word for a stopwatch, when five such things exist in a watch, it's given the title grand. And this one truly is grand, made by Breguet, who was the same fellow, by the way, who made watches both for Napoleon and Wellington. In fact, the Battle of Waterloo was timed on both sides by Breguet pocket watches.
Now, this novel isn't a sequel to your first book in any sense, except for the props. The grand complication itself is mentioned in the first book and the case of curiosities. Why did you decide to use them again?
Well, I finished the first book back in 1991. And in the course of an interview, I foolishly said that I might spend a year or two trying to figure out what that final 10th compartment in the case of curiosities contained. And the 2 or 3 years that I thought I might spend ballooned into 9. And then there was the search for the watch itself, which required me to travel to Jerusalem, to go to the museum where the theft took place, to the watchmaking valleys of the Jura outside of Geneva, where many of the techniques that are in the Grand Complication continue to be performed by watchmakers. And I even had to go to the Isle of Man off the coast of England to talk to the probably greatest living watchmaker and heir to the talents and sensibilities of Abraham Louis Breguet.
Do you, like your librarian Alexander Short in The Grand Complication, do you have a compulsion to make lists and to put things in order?
I certainly don't have his compulsion, but I do have some of the props that he has. I'm blessed with a wife who made me any number of the things that appear in the novel.
Really?
I carry a girdle book around with me occasionally, which is a little notebook attached to my jacket with a piece of twine. And there are any number of other items in the novel that I've actually made or had made.
His wife in the novel also makes erotic pop-up books. Are you so lucky?
No, my wife is actually an anthropologist. Her expertise is Aboriginal Australian culture. But I did take classes in pop-up design, and though I didn't personally make a pop-up Kama Sutra, which appears in the novel, I did make a number of other not terribly competent stabs at the design of pop-up books.
You also went to the trouble of actually making some of the devices that appear in the book. On the first few pages of the book, that says role player patent pending. This is something that comes up in the book, and you actually made it?
Yeah, my wife rolled her eyes at that one, too. I was reading an account of Goethe's travels down to Italy, and it was a magnificent description of this note-taker that he designed. It was a box with a scroll, and he would crank a handle and then take notes and crank a handle some more. So that precipitated a year-long search for patent materials on role players of one kind or another. And then I eventually decided just to design my own. So the guts of the machine I got down in Wichita, Kansas, at the a role player company that restores old player pianos. And I went up to Buffalo and talked to people who design paper for player pianos. A year later, the role player was made. And its motto, which is one that's dear to my heart, is volumes of higher learning operated by a crank.
You said you just decided that you ought to go ahead and do one of your own. You weren't satisfied with the ones that existed, or something about it that fascinated you?
Well, the idea of actually making the things that my characters make was highly attractive to me. I had spent the better part of 6 years on the first book, and I didn't make anything besides the book itself. So I decided to indulge that interest in tinkering, legacy of my father's profession as a mechanical engineer, on the second novel, which may account for why it took as long as it did.
You take us in this novel to parts of the main branch of the New York Public Library that visitors never get to see. You actually worked in the library for a while. What was that like?
That was paradise. Imagine if you were a Wordsworth scholar and someone said, Here are the keys to Dove Cottage. Mm-hmm. Or if you were doing a biography of Elvis Presley and they said, hey, we've got a spare room at Graceland. You want to make use of it for a year? That's what happened to me. I'd been working on this book for 4 or 5 years, maybe even more, and I suddenly got the opportunity to have a fellowship that gave me carte blanche to the entire New York Public Library, from the top of the rotunda to the subterranean parts where the generators of the zip tubes are stored. And I took full advantage of that opportunity.
The zip tubes are the pneumatic tubes that send messages and call slips throughout the library?
That's right. There was a moment when they were going to pull those brass tubes out of the system when they renovated the library. Fortunately, some visionary figured out that the zip tubes were just as effective, in fact, better suited to the transmission of paper than fax machines or electronic apparatuses.
A lot of people have said that it is a little peculiar to set essentially an action novel, a thriller, with a librarian as the protagonist.
Oh, yeah, but I would disagree with them. I think that librarians get a bum rap. They're constantly represented as these staid do-gooders, hair in a bun, glasses on the nose. In fact, librarians have better eyesight than most professionals. And on political lines, they tend to be activists and renegades. They're nonconformists by nature. I mean, think about what they have to do all day. They're pulling up incredible works of fiction. They're handing Dostoevsky to high school students, if they're lucky. They're giving Merck manuals to people with serious illnesses. They're trying to help people crushed by taxes. They are on the front lines of people and extremists. And I think that reference librarians need a better representation than the ones you find in The Music Man.
As we were talking about earlier, though, one of the things they do is try to bring order out of chaos. That's the nature of their job.
That's one kind of librarian. But there's another kind of a librarian who sees his calling or her calling as a middleman of knowledge. And it's those librarians that I'm particularly interested. They're the ones who break the rules. They're the ones who sneak into the conservation lab and take a book that requires rebinding and places it in the hands of an eager researcher because that book needs to be read.
And that sort of pursuit, I'm interested because the first time that Alexander Short, your character, sees the case of curiosities and notices 10 niches, the first thing he says is, ah, Dewey set his system in 10 separate groups as well.
Well, decimal systems fascinate me for reasons I can't begin to explain. The first novel, in addition to having 10 compartments, was also structured around the design of a pocket watch, and particularly a pocket watch made by Breguet that had 10 hours to the day. It was a form of revolutionary timekeeping, an effort on the part of the Committee of Public Safety to reinvent time. So they eradicated royal time with its 12-hour dial and gave us a completely new sense of time. They had 100-hour days, each hour having 100 minutes, and each hour having 100 seconds. The vocabularies of watchmaking and bookmaking overlap time and time again.
In both of your books, The Case of Curiosities and The Grand Complication, there was a relationship between the main character, in this case Alexander Short, the librarian, and this collector under whose tutelage he then seeks the queen, the Marie Antoinette watch. In the other book, it's a young man who comes under the tutelage of the abbé. And I wonder if there's a parallel mentor in your life. Your father died when you were rather young.
My father died when I was 5. And I did have a couple of stepfathers between then and now. Was there a particular mentor in my life? Was there a particular abbé in my life?
Mm-hmm.
No. I think that that's one of the reasons I was drawn to fiction. Fiction allows you to fill those empty compartments in your life that might otherwise remain voids. Writing books is a license to inhabit those spaces you might otherwise not have a chance to live in. I grew up with people who read books with pencils in their hands, and that clearly had an effect on me.
Now, your cousin is Ray Kurzweil, an inventor and, well, I'm not exactly sure what to call him. I'm not sure futurist really covers it, but he's a guy who's been living in the 21st century for some time now, and also an inventor. I guess it runs in the family.
Yeah, Ray is certainly the most prominent example of Kurzweil engineering. But as I said, my father was also an engineer, and he began by making machines. Then he started making machines that made machines. And by the end of his career, he was making machines that made machines that made machines.
Is that machine tools? Or what kind of machines are we talking about?
Yeah, he went over. Both he and my mother are Viennese-born emigres. He went back to Europe under the Marshall Plan and worked for the machine tool industry for many years. In fact, up to the time of his death. And I inherited one thing from him when he passed away. And that was a pocket watch, his father's.
Do you still have it?
That is the one thing I do feel very attached to, yes. And it's contained, actually, in a wooden case.
Alan Kurzweil's new novel is The Grand Complication. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, rock jazz fusion then and now. Critic Kevin Whitehead looks at Miles Davis and the Chicago Underground Quartet. This is Fresh Air. In 1970, trumpeter Miles Davis sometimes played rock venues with an electric band that mixed the jazz and pop music of its time. These days, that description might fit the Chicago Underground Quartet, who record for a rock label and play rock and roll bars. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the two bands sound very different, but then jazz and pop aren't what they were 30 years ago either.
Back in 1970, rock was deep into improvisation. Musicians like Hendrix and Cream had ushered in the long, bluesy jam, conceptual cousin to Miles Davis's long, modal improvisations years earlier. In 1970, James Brown's choppy funk rhythms were in vogue, too. That was the context when the quiet trumpeter became the loudest man in jazz. There's plenty of electric Miles out, but a newly issued concert recording from the Fillmore East in March 1970 blows much of it away. Saxophonist Wayne Shorter was about to leave Miles after 5.5 years. The caffeinated rhythm trio was drummer Jack DeJohnette, Chick Corea on electric piano, and bassist Dave Holland, also heard on wah-wah bass guitar. Pop music rarely tolerates improvisation for long. A slew of endless live rock albums killed off jamming in the 70s. Nowadays, rock and pop tend to be more disciplined and controlled. Jazz, too. So, imagine the sound of modern improvisers influenced by a pop environment where songs are built in discrete layers, electronics add a cool veneer, and dance rhythms draw on hip-hop loops, old Euro disco, and loping Jamaican dub records. Chicago Underground Quartet from their untitled CD on Thrill Jockey. Some call this ambient jazz by analogy with old Brian Eno records like Music for Airports, sonic mobiles you could listen to or let blend with the wallpaper. To make unobtrusive music that doesn't snooze is as confining and challenging as getting dressed in an upper berth. Such music is often bad, but there's something about the Chicago Underground I like. They show how digital rhythms and modern recording techniques can influence how live musicians play, but there are enough human touches or twitches to keep it from sounding robotic. Guitarist Jeff Parker's Three in the Morning is dominated by a simple pentatonic riff, but he and cornetist Rob Mazurek and bassist Noel Coopersmith put their stamp on it by improvising in small bursts. They leapfrog each other. If Electric Miles risked going too far, the Chicago Underground doesn't always go far enough. I wish some compositions had more substance, sending the quartet someplace besides Twice Around the Block. There are some dabs of free jazz to open things up, but even those episodes sound constrained. The Chicago Underground's whole concept is deliberately ambiguous. Even the size of the band varies, from a so-called orchestra to the duo of horn player Mazurek and drummer and vibraphonist Chad Taylor. Their stuff isn't quite foreground or background music, electric or acoustic, free or programmed, jazz or whatever. That's not ambient, that's ambivalent. Sometimes, the fabric is so fragile, it could tear at any time. So whenever they lay it out without mishap, it's a small triumph. Small, but real.
Kevin Whitehead is currently living in Chicago. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Roberta Schorock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at SaabUSA.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again, a novel by Elizabeth McCracken, the author of The Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Wild Blue, historian Stephen Ambrose on the men and boys who flew the B-24 bombers over Germany and the terrible price they paid to bring Hitler's economy to a standstill. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.